Good evening and welcome to the Sunday Monitor. This is KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. We have a busy show for you tonight as usual. Just wanted to say that I am Mark Grabowy along with Margaret Bryant. Pokey Anderson is still out of town. She should be back in a couple of weeks. Tonight we have two live interviews. The first will be with Washington College of Law professor Herman Schwartz. We'll be talking to him about the courts, the judicial appointments, and the legal ramifications of the upcoming presidential election. Our second guest will be Jimmy Water. He spent $1.5 million of his own money already to launch an advertising blitz in America's most prominent newspapers and magazines, including full-page ads in Business Week, Forbes, Newsweek, and the New York Times, the Washington Post, Reader's Digest, and others. The ads are entitled, "Are We Safer Now?" The 9/11 report has been published, but some very troubling questions remain unanswered. He'll be telling us today about his campaign to reopen the investigation into the events of September 11th. First up, the news headlines. With so little time left before the presidential election, an increasing number of people are keen to have their say. It got almost no coverage at the time, but the statement released by the group claiming responsibility for the Madrid bombing in March of this year said it supported U.S. President George W. Bush in his re-election campaign and would prefer him to win in November rather than Democratic candidate John Kerry, as it was not possible to find a leader, quote, more foolish than Bush, who deals with matters by force rather than wisdom, unquote. In comments addressed to Bush, the group said, quote, Kerry will kill our nation while it sleeps because he and the Democrats have the cunning to embellish blasphemy and present it to the Arab and Muslim nation as civilization. Because of this, we desire Bush to be elected, unquote. The authenticity of that statement has not been questioned by U.S. sources. It seems to have been accepted as legitimately originating from the group that carried out the bombings in Spain. Well, President Bush got another endorsement this week. Hassan Rouhani, the head of Iran's Security Council, told local media sources in Iran that Tehran's best interests are served by the re-election of George W. Bush. These endorsements for Bush by Iran and al-Qaeda would seem to indicate that both parties think they have more to gain by Bush staying in office. David Jagannath, the editor of the Oregon Daily Emerald, wrote about the Iranian endorsement of President Bush yesterday, saying the following, quote, when future historians write about this year, I suspect they will sum it up like this. In the year 2003, neoconservatives within the Bush administration were duped by the Iranian double agent into attacking Iraq and removing Saddam Hussein in order to pave the way for a pro-Iran, Shia-controlled Iraq. It is one of the greatest acts of espionage ever perpetrated against the superpower, unquote. The double agent that he is referring to is Ahmad Chalabi, the leader of the Iraqi National Congress. He has since fallen out of favor with the current administration, but was once thought to be poised to become Iraq's next president. Instead, it seems likely that another Iraqi formerly on the CIA payroll, Iyad Alawi, will step into that role. It seems strange that al-Qaeda, the group we're told was responsible for 9/11, and Iran, the country that formed the foundation of the so-called Axis of Evil, have both endorsed the president for a second term, and stranger still that these endorsements have gotten so little mention in the media. We will continue to monitor this story as it develops.
In the Iraqi Oil for Food program established by the United Nations, U.S. companies could purchase petroleum, and the proceeds from the sales were to be used to supply pipeline parts and equipment or humanitarian goods for Iraqi citizens. The U.N. allowed Saddam Hussein to pick the customers he would sell oil to and those contracts he would buy goods from. In 2000, Saddam began charging a surcharge for Iraqi oil. A former Iraqi government tally of secret payments made from September 2000 to December 2003 lists Coastal Corporation, founded by Houston oilman Oscar Wyatt Jr., as having paid over $200,000 in surcharges on approximately 1 million barrels of oil. Two other companies Wyatt is associated with, Nafta Petroleum of Cyprus and Medinafta Petroleum of Cyprus, are listed as having paid $7 million in surcharges. Wyatt said through a spokesman that he had no knowledge of Coastal's paying any surcharges. Wyatt and Hussein had a long and mutually prosperous relationship. They had first met in 1972, and in 1990, after Iraq invaded Kuwait, Wyatt helped negotiate the release of American hostages held as human shields. In 1996, Coastal secured the first shipment of oil sold under the Oil for Food program. Coastal, not one of the country's largest oil companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco, depended heavily on Iraqi oil. In an interview earlier this year, Wyatt said, "The majors controlled the Saudi Arabian oil. Most of the Abu Dhabi crude was contracted to Asia, so those that didn't have contracts had an opportunity with Iraqi sour crude." According to CIA estimates, Wyatt and the companies he has been linked to earned an estimated $23 million in profits in the 7 years of the Oil for Food program. Having his name on the Iraqi list of those who paid a surcharge has led congressional committees, the Treasury Department, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan to make inquiries into Wyatt's actions.
Continuing with Iraqi news briefly, we heard earlier this morning that between 45 and 50 Iraqi military police were killed on their way back to their homes after having completed their training and certification program. This is an indication of many things, but the least of which is the organization level, the deadly organization level within the Iraqi resistance. Three out of four self-described supporters of President George W. Bush still believe that pre-war Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or active programs to produce them, and that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein provided substantial support to al-Qaeda. This is according to a new survey released on Thursday. Moreover, as many more Bush supporters hold these beliefs today than they did several months ago, before the publication of a series of well-publicized official government reports that debunked both of those notions. Those are among the most striking findings of the survey, which was conducted in mid-October by the University of Maryland's Program on International Policy Attitudes, the PIPA, and Knowledge Networks, a California-based polling firm. An article on this subject was written by Jim Loeb, a two-time guest on this show, for oneworld.net on Friday. Loeb quotes the University of Maryland's program, saying, "The current election is unique in that Bush supporters and Kerry supporters have profoundly different perceptions of reality. In the face of a stream of high-level assessments about pre-war Iraq, Bush supporters cling to the refuted beliefs that Iraq had WMD or supported al-Qaeda." Indeed, the only issue on which the survey found broad agreement between the two sets of voters was on the question of whether the Bush administration itself had been actively propagating the misconceptions about Iraq's WMD connections, Iraq's WMDs and their connection to al-Qaeda. Stephen Cull, the PIPA director, said, quote, "One of the reasons that Bush supporters have these erroneous beliefs is that they perceive the Bush administration confirming them." Interestingly, this is one point on which Bush and Kerry supporters agree. Remarkably, when asked whether the U.S. should have gone to war with Iraq if U.S. intelligence had concluded that Baghdad did not have a WMD program and was not providing support to al-Qaeda, 58% of Bush supporters said no, and 61% said they assumed that Bush would also not have gone to war under those circumstances. To read the article in full, go to commondreams.org and do a search for Jim Loeb.
Keeping with Iraq. As they say, timing is everything, and for the past couple of weeks, the White House website concerning Iraq has been under revision. The link enumerating the 50 countries that openly backed the March 2003 invasion into Iraq has disappeared. White House spokesman Jimmy Orr told reporters, "What we are doing right now with the entire Iraq site is we're updating the information." He would not say when the site would return. Critical pundits charged the removal of the site as an attempt to protect Vice President Dick Cheney from being accused of misspeaking. They point to the vice presidential debates when Edwards charged that the U.S. had suffered 90% of the casualties in Iraq. Cheney refuted Edwards, saying Edwards was incorrect because he did not include the casualties of the Iraqi security forces. But Iraq has never been considered a coalition member and was never on the official White House list of coalition nations.
Three members of the military panel established to hear the cases of Guantanamo Bay prisoners have been removed because of concerns about their lack of impartiality. But the officer acting as a senior judge, who has close links to the Pentagon officials overseeing the hearings, has been allowed to retain his position. Following criticism from defense lawyers and human rights groups, John Altenberg, a Pentagon official and retired Army general, agreed to remove three military officers from the six-member panel. One of the officers had overseen an operation that sent suspected terrorists from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay. Another was an intelligence officer in Iraq, and a third caused controversy earlier this summer when he said he did not know the details of the Geneva Conventions. But Mr. Altenberg, who has the title of appointing authority for the commission, refused to remove the panel's senior officer, Colonel Peter Brownback, whose presence has been questioned by defense and prosecution lawyers because of a perceived lack of impartiality. Mr. Brownback and Mr. Altenberg worked together at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, while Mr. Brownback spoke at a retirement roast for Mr. Altenberg and attended the wedding of his son. His wife worked in Mr. Altenberg's office. The developments are just the latest twist in the Bush administration's efforts to deal with the 600 or so prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay, among them four British citizens. Earlier this summer, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that all of the prisoners had the right to challenge their incarceration in the U.S. courts. The Bush administration has so far refused to grant them this access. Instead, the Pentagon is proceeding with efforts to try the prisoners on military tribunals that were established by an executive order signed by Mr. Bush in November of 2001. Such tribunals, at which defendants have fewer legal protections than in a normal court, have not been held in the U.S. since the end of World War II.
In two states, Washington and Nevada, the issue of nuclear waste will be on voters' minds. By all estimates, a Washington state referendum to tell the federal government not to truck more radioactive waste to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation will be approved by voters. Creators of the initiative say the catalyst to fight back came in 2000 when the Energy Department decided to begin to send waste from around the country to Hanford, which was already a Superfund site. Hanford is a huge complex in southeastern Washington that in its heyday busily dumped out plutonium for the nation's nuclear bombs. Cleanup has been underway for more than a decade, and this year alone it will cost $2 billion. Opponents of the initiative say it could delay cleanup if other states are inspired to hold their own votes and could thwart the government's plan to create a national repository of radioactive waste at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Moreover, the federal government has broad powers to transport and deposit nuclear waste, and few nuclear environmental lawyers believe Washington's challenge will hold up in court. The people of Nevada are not happy that the Bush administration is pushing to have the nation's radioactive reserve in their state. In 2000, Bush won the state by only 22,000 votes and has promised not to approve the Yucca Mountain site until it had been deemed scientifically safe, is credited with helping him win the state. In this election year, Nevada is a frequently visited swing state. Kerry has come out opposing a national radioactive repository. Bush has defended his stance, saying, "I said I would make a decision based upon sound science, not politics, and that's exactly what I did." However, many Nevada citizens are aware of the Geological Society of America's report, which warned that should moisture enter the mountain where nuclear waste is stored in bundles of rods, it would result in radioactive volcanoes forming on the surface. Scientists have nicknamed the mountain Old Rickety, and the Native American name is Moving Hill.
Well, that's all the time we have for headlines today. We're going to take a very short break right now, but we'll be back with Washington College of Law Professor Herman Schwartz to discuss the legal ramifications of this election and other things to do with courts and systems, which is a much overlooked subject, in my opinion. So stay tuned for that. We'll be right back. This is the Sunday Monitor on KPFT 90.1 FM. Joining us now live on the phone is Herman Schwartz. He is a professor at the Washington College of Law at the American University. He's the author of many books, including Packing the Courts, The Struggle for Constitutional Justice in Post-Communist Europe. He's the editor of the Rehnquist Court. He's also a former chief counsel and staff director of the United States Senate Antitrust and Monopoly Subcommittee and a former member of the U.S. delegation to the UN Human Rights Commission and to the World Human Rights Conference. He consulted with numerous former Soviet bloc countries on constitutional and human rights reform. A new book he's just published recently is called Right Wing Justice, the Conservative Campaign to Take Over the Courts. Herman Schwartz, welcome to the Sunday Monitor.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks for joining us. I wanted to start with you. Basically, the premise of this book that you've just released is that there is a conservative campaign to pack the Supreme Court and lower courts with what you're calling reactionary judges who are more identified with their ideological affiliation than their regard for the Constitution. Can you expand on that thesis a little bit for us?
Yeah, I think that what we're living through is a triple counter-revolution, of which the courts are a crucial element. This is a revolution against two aspects of the 30s New Deal: the notion that the federal government has a responsibility to take care of people in trouble, and the notion that market forces can't be allowed to run wild without federal regulation. The other revolution that took place is in the 50s and 60s, civil rights, culture, women's rights, abortion, and the rest. And both, all three of those have started the conservative forces in America. The cultural and civil rights ones initially started with in the South, of course, with the reaction, which we're still seeing. But at that time, the South was Democratic because of historic reasons related to this Civil War and earlier. It has since come to its natural resting home, which is the Republican Party, the conservative party in America. The other two, the welfare state and the regulatory state, that stirred up traditional Republicans right from the beginning, who saw Roosevelt as, you know, that man, the traitor. And starting with Reagan, there was a concerted effort. Well, actually, it started with Barry Goldwater and then with Nixon's Southern strategy. But it really moved over to the courts at the lower court level and the Supreme Court level with Reagan, followed by Bush 1, who essentially followed up on Reagan, what Reagan had done, and Bush 2, who has pushed it to an extreme. And so the agenda of these judges is essentially undo these, as much as possible, of these three constitutional and, in some ways, statutory revolutions.
Well, we have I guess the only time that this has really come up in the presidential debates was the whole abortion issue, and,
yes,
and the president managed to not answer the question, in my mind, when he was asked whether he would reverse Roe v. Wade. What's your comment on the nature of the appointments that were made under Reagan and Bush and Clinton, and where do you see upcoming appointments? Although the president said he doesn't have a litmus test, whatever that means,
yeah,
maybe you can comment on the people who are appointed to the Supreme Court by previous presidents and where we would expect the Supreme Court to go under George Bush if he remains in office.
Well, I mean, to start with Reagan, what you saw as soon at the first opportunity, apart from the Supreme Court, on the lower court, was to fill it up with very ideological, largely academic people, Scalia, Bork, and others, Frank Easterbrook. There are a whole bunch of names which, until there was the Supreme Court issue, few people pay any attention to, except those of us who were sort of in the business of paying attention, namely constitutional lawyers, civil rights lawyers, environmental lawyers, reproductive rights lawyers, and the like. The first appointment was essentially Sandra Day O'Connor, who is far more conservative than most people realize, because except for a couple of issues, the justice with whom she votes most often is Rehnquist, averaging about 85 to 93 or 4%, sometimes higher.
90% agreement with him, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
And the next appointment was Scalia, because, Rehnquist to the chief, replacing Berger, and the fight was all about Rehnquist, who got more votes against him as Chief Justice than anybody else in history. Scalia was able to slide by. Nobody paid any attention to him. Then, on the Supreme Court level, the next effort was, of course, the Bork fight. And Bork lost essentially because he lost the South. The Democratic senators of the South, and at that point the key fact was that the Democrats controlled the Senate by a small margin, so that the nomination couldn't be rushed through. Southern Democrats like Heflin and Breaux and others, who were basically very conservative people, and in those days were Democrats, now most of them have shifted over to become Republicans, like Shelby and some others, would not go along because Southern blacks and a lot of Southern women were terrified of Bork because of what he'd written and said.
Can you give me an example of one of the things he said?
Oh, he had said that the contraception decision was unconstitutional, the 1965 reproductive rights contraception decision. He had argued against almost every civil rights law. He had said the public accommodations law, which was passed in the 1960s, was also unconstitutional. His views were then very far to the right and have actually become even farther. So on so many issues of concern to women and minorities, he frightened people. Also church-state issues, a good many others. And even before the hearings began, polls that were taken showed that he was going to lose. Now, as Reagan's choices after that, who were very conservative, like Douglas Ginsburg, who's now sitting on the Court of Appeals in Washington, failed. And he settled for Anthony Kennedy because he was afraid that by then he wouldn't get anybody. This was 88 already. So, or late 87. Kennedy took his seat in March 88. And Kennedy has, except on issues of gay rights and a few others, proven to be also very conservative. That's why you have so many 5-4 decisions, usually going conservatively. Then, when Bush came along, nobody knew who Souter was. And he was recommended by somebody who by no stretch of the imagination was anything but a strong conservative, John Sununu, Bush's chief of staff. He was also, however, recommended by Warren Rudman, who is one of the few remaining Northeast Republican moderates, although he's no longer in the Senate. The next nomination was Clarence Thomas. There, the black vote was overwhelmingly in his favor, and so he was able to win by a bare margin. And those are those appointments. Now, Clinton's appointments, Clinton had no interest at all in ideology. He said it, at least not so much he did, but his the White House counsel, then Abner Mikva, the Assistant Attorney General, Eleanor Acheson, who was in charge of judicial nominations, they were interested only in, I guess, three things. Intellect, of course, but secondly, women, and thirdly, minorities. And although, by and large, his nominations, even conservatives admitted, were really very much down the middle, there was he changed the face of the federal judiciary by so many women and minorities.
So, I'm going to just interrupt you for
sure.
A second, because I think a lot of people may not be familiar with a lot of these names, and it seems to me that the picture you're painting is one of broadly conservative-leaning judges being appointed for, I guess, the last 3 decades, maybe?
Since 1981.
Okay, so we're heading into almost 3 decades of this,
yeah.
And I guess the philosophical question from a non-legal mind would be
no.
That these people are appointed by the sitting president, who in theory won a majority of the vote, although as we know that doesn't always apply, and isn't it the president's job to represent his electorate, and if the president is conservative, should he not then appoint more conservative people to the courts? I guess that's one of the underlying questions.
Sure, the answer is that he should, but that doesn't mean they should be confirmed.
Right.
Because the Senate proposes, there's nothing in the Constitution that anybody is entitled even to a vote. The Senate advises and consents. And where Supreme Court nominations are concerned, over 20%, one out of every three in the 19th century, were rejected for one reason or another, usually politics or ideology, the Civil War, various other issues like that. I think Grant got almost no appointments until the very end. So that...
And the names you mentioned, basically since Reagan's time, have not been opposed or rejected at all. They've kind of squeaked through for the most
Thomas,
part.
Thomas, of course, was very much opposed.
Right.
But he managed to get through for the reasons I mentioned.
Right.
I mean, it all depends on one's vision of the country and the Constitution.
Well, the Constitution, you know, is really what brings me to the pressing question that I have. And you mentioned that a lot of decisions tend to go 5-4 in towards conservative leanings.
Yes.
And, of course, one of the most obvious ones was the Florida decision in 2000.
Yes.
Can we expect something similar to this time around? Already we have a lot of lawsuits being filed about voter rights being suppressed and voting machines and all kinds of other irregularities that are going on. Do you think that we will know on November 3rd who the president is, or is it going to be a drawn-out process with many lawsuits and Supreme Court intervention?
I really don't. I can't possibly know, partly because on a personal note, I have no conception of how this country is leaning at the moment. The polls are all over the place, and they're very, very flawed. It depends a lot on the margin of victory.
Right.
If the margin is very great, I don't know that these lawsuits, which are, I think, I don't know that they will make a difference. As to whether we'll get a repeat of Bush against Gore, I think Justice O'Connor in particular, but also perhaps Justice Kennedy, will not go along. The other three will do, I think, whatever is required. But I can't even know that.
Required by whom?
To maintain a Republican president.
Okay.
But, this is rankest form of speculation. There's simply no way of knowing. There was an uproar about Bush against Gore. I have heard that at least one of those justices was very upset by that and didn't anticipate that. And that could make a difference. Who knows?
Well, let me shift gears a little bit.
Sure.
What about the relationship between the executive branch and the judiciary? It seems to me that the current administration has more obviously open friendships or relationships with certain members of the Supreme Court. Dick Cheney and Antonin Scalia specifically spring to mind. Is this unprecedented in U.S. politics?
No, I'm afraid not.
Well, when else was it happening, and what lessons can we learn from the past?
Frankfurter and Roosevelt were very close, even after Frankfurter went on the court. Fortas and Lyndon Johnson. I'm sure in earlier years there were others. What is particularly disturbing here, and really very, very upsetting, is that I can't recall a situation in which a justice went off on, just essentially in a small party or by themselves with somebody who was directly involved as a litigant.
You're talking about the
I'm
energy.
I'm talking about Cheney.
Yeah, the energy.
Directly challenged his task force on energy.
And that was headed up by Antonin Scalia, the investigation.
No. It was headed up probably by.
Scalia was sitting in judgment on that.
Yes, Scalia was sitting in judgment, and I think that's unconscionable.
It struck me as quite odd that most people don't pay attention to a lot of these things, and the whole issue of the upcoming appointments has really escaped it. But I guess if you watch late-night talk shows, you may have heard this line from Jay Leno, which really surprised me. It got a lot of laughs from the audience, but it kind of fizzled out the next day, and no one really talked about it. He said he was joking about Dick Cheney going through airport security and setting off the alarms, and they made him empty his pockets, and out fell Antonin Scalia. And, this got a huge roar of laughter from the audience, but people are kind of accepting of it. And what's your view on the American public's perception of the role of the courts and what their courts' relationship should be with the executive branch, and where is the sentiment towards the courts these days? Do you have any feeling for that?
Well, I think the Supreme Court, from its earliest days in particular, and has had such enormous prestige in this country that it can get away with almost anything. Bush against Gore, the individual justices. I think most people don't pay much attention to the courts as courts. They pay attention to them as people who decide cases like Brown or Roe against Wade or affirmative action. Most people really aren't interested in the judicial process, the whole judicial setup. They're interested solely in the results. And so if Roe against Wade is is issued, you get this uproar from, I guess, about a quarter or a third or something of the American people. But it doesn't hurt the court. No effort in Congress to limit the court has ever succeeded since, I think, sometime the 19th century. So I think that Americans are very proud of their courts, sort of without thinking much about them one way or the other, and accept the notion that courts, as any sensible person would, make public policy. And if they like the public policy, they like the courts. If they don't like the public policy, they don't like the courts in that connection. But the courts as a whole, I think, really have an individual justices have a very strong hold on the American people.
We've mentioned Roe v. Wade a couple of times and Brown versus the Board of Education. Do you think that, well, first of all, take us through the mechanics of getting one of those decisions overturned. How would that happen?
Well, essentially, the issue of, well, Brown will never be overturned. As a practical matter, it's been rendered of no force where school desegregation is concerned. It stands as one of the greatest decisions in American history, primarily because that with Brown, the notion of courts as vehicles of social justice took hold for about 30 years, up to about 1987-88, when Kennedy came on the court, declining, but to some extent. Now that's not true anymore, or is hardly true. So Brown's legacy is really that, and of course, the massive change in American life.
Mm-hmm.
Roe against Wade, it would come up in a variety of cases where a law is passed which is challenged as interfering with the right to abortion. And in defending it, the state or locality that passes it would say, not only is this consistent with Roe against Wade, but Roe against Wade should be overturned. And that would work its way through the trial court, through the Federal Court of Appeals. And if the composition of the court were changed by a Bush presidency, and if there is a Bush presidency, it will be changed, because it's almost certain that there will be one or two and perhaps more retirements or departures. It's possible to cut Roe against Wade back even more than it was cut in 1993 or 92 with the Casey case, as a result of which some 400 state and local laws were adopted to try to limit abortions. And by and large, they've succeeded with respect to women in small towns who don't have very much money.
Now, the Casey case, is that, can you expand on that just a little bit?
That was a case which upheld a great many restrictions on the right to abortion, the 24-hour waiting period, mm-hmm. The doctor has, these are state statutes, the doctor must give information about adoption and describe all the negative psychological consequences of an abortion, as well as other consequences, but definitely the negative. And a variety, I think there were some five separate regulations which had been struck down prior to the Casey case. But then when Thomas and Kennedy came onto the court, they were upheld.
Now, there's one legal issue which has come up repeatedly, and that's the whole idea of a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. What is the court's role in all of that if it were to come up?
Well, if there were a constitutional amendment, the court would have no role. It would simply apply the Constitution as amended. But that's not going to happen. That's simply a political ploy. That's simply not going to happen. It's the Defense of Marriage Act went through, whatever that may mean. But this will not.
Let's go back, just then, we have a few minutes left.
Sure.
I want to go back just to the issue of appointments.
Yeah.
I had heard some rumors before the 2000 elections that some Supreme Court justices were considering staying on or retiring, depending on who won the election. And some similar rumors appear to be flying around this time again. Can you speculate a little bit on who may be due for retirement soon? And obviously, the next president would replace them. And also, would, for example, a Kerry victory preempt certain justices from retiring? Would they wait another 4 years and hope for a Republican president maybe to be in?
Well, the person where there is some evidence about this in the 2000 election was Sandra Day O'Connor, who was reported in Newsweek to have said something the night of the election when it looked as if the Florida vote were going the other way, about that this would prevent her from retiring, something like that. I think her husband actually is supposed to have told somebody that. It's difficult to say. The reasons for the retirements, insofar as Justice Stevens is concerned, would not be that factor because he's 84, and that might be simply age. It could be with Chief Justice Rehnquist. But many of us thought he would retire during these 4 years. And the question is, some people have said, well, what else would he do? He's in pretty good health. The other possibility is Justice O'Connor, who has a very powerful position on the court at the moment, but has children in Arizona and has talked about going back to Arizona. With a Kerry victory, should that happen, she might decide to go back. On the theory that sooner or later there would be more Kerry appointments. Who knows?
And how old is she?
She's about 72, 73, 74, in that range. She was in the same law school class as Rehnquist, but Rehnquist had done some graduate work. I think she's about 74. I don't think it's a question of age there.
Is there a precedent for a Supreme Court justice being removed due to being unable to carry out their duties?
Yes, Justice Douglas wasn't so much removed, but was very pressured by his family and the other justices to leave.
So even though it's a lifetime appointment, it is possible for people to be deemed no longer able to function?
No. I mean, as a practical matter, almost never. This the notion of a lifetime appointment means natural life, and
or until they choose to retire, of course.
Until they choose,
right?
So the result of it is, it's not a good system because it means somebody can sit in that unaccountable position for 20, 30, 40 years, and a democracy should not have that for that length of time.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think on that note we're going to have to end it there. But the book makes for very interesting reading. It's called Right Wing Justice, The Conservative Campaign to Take Over the Courts. Herman Schwartz, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll definitely have you back on post-election and see what's going on with the Supreme Court.
Thanks very much.
I appreciate it. Herman Schwartz is a professor at the Washington College of Law at the American University. You can get his book from Nation Books, and you can also find him on the WCL website. We'll take a very short break right now, but when we come back, we'll have Jimmy Walter to discuss 9/11. Stay tuned. This is KPFT Houston. You're listening to the Sunday Monitor, and finishing off the show, we have a live interview with Jimmy Walter. Jimmy Walter is a multimillionaire. He's spent over $1.5 million of his own money to launch an advertising campaign in many of America's most prominent newspapers and magazines calling for a reopening of the investigation into 9/11. Jimmy Walter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Well, some of the people, I've been looking at your website, walden3.org, and some of the people who you mention on there have been guests on this show, including David Ray Griffin and David Von Kleist. We've also had Sybil Edmonds and Ray McGovern on the show previously, and they've all discussed the failings of the 9/11 Commission. One of the things that you mention on your website is the high percentage of New Yorkers who would like 9/11 to be reinvestigated. Do you want to take us from that as a starting point and then tell us about your campaign?
Sure. I commissioned a Zogby poll right before 9/11 this year, and that came back that 66% of New York City residents want 9/11 reopened, that 49% believe members of the administration knew about it in advance and let it happen, 40% statewide in the state of New York believe this, and it is, in my opinion, pardon the pun, criminal, that this report, the 9/11 Commission report, overlooks everything going into the Terrorist Act, and then purports this silly pancake theory as a reason the buildings collapse. When you look at the pictures closely and carefully, you can see the buildings being blown apart, steel beams flying horizontally out from the building at hundreds of miles an hour, going hundreds of feet, dust clouds enveloping the whole neighborhood. This doesn't happen from a collapse. The top of the World Trade Tower, both of them were hit off center. And in fact, one of them did tip over. And because it tipped over, it completely destroys the pancake theory. The pancake theory goes that the steel beams in the middle of the building were weakened, and then the upper floors collapsed, causing a cascading collapse down the building. But in fact, one of the towers leaned over and fell down on the side, so there was no weight to cause this alleged collapse down. And the censure of all of them is that there is another building there called Building 7, a third skyscraper, this one only 47 stories tall, not hit by an airplane, not hit by falling debris from the towers, had small but no significant fires in them, and yet it collapsed at 5:30 that day, just like a controlled demolition. In fact, you can see that when the ads are running in New York. We show that demolition, then we show a controlled demolition. And FEMA said they have no idea why this building collapsed. FEMA is a Federal Emergency Management Association. But Larry Silverstein...
This is what I was just going to bring up, actually, whether you'd heard what Larry Silverstein said about
on
that.
On tape. You can buy it. I think it's something America remembers. I may have the name wrong. But he says that he told the fire department to pull it. And pull it is an industry-specific term to the demolition industry. And it refers to pulling the walls in so the building falls down on its own center, exactly as the World Trade Towers did.
And from the video that I've seen, that's definitely how World Trade Center 7 went down. It takes a lot of planning to bring down a building like that.
Well, plus and the fire department doesn't do it. That's
right.
Not the fire department function.
Well, Larry Silverstein's quote that day, and I've seen the tape, he said basically that he told the fire and rescue workers who were in the building to get out because there'd been so much loss of life already that day that they should pull the building.
Right.
So the obvious question is, when were the explosives planted for them to be able to pull this building?
Well, a normal demolition...
And how could they do it in 4 hours?
Well, construction demolition professionals take a minimum of 2 weeks and up to 2 months to look at a building, plan it, place the charges. Now, remember this also. Who would be running around in a building that's so full of fire that you have to get out placing explosives in just the right spots? The building had to be pre-wired. And if that building was pre-wired, how can we rule out the other two trade buildings? If you go back and rent, you can rent the movies at Blockbuster, CNN, America Remembers, something like that, but the CNN one, and then the other one is Commemorative Edition, the Filmmaker's Commemorative Edition, and you can see the clouds of smoke, and the buildings fell at the speed of gravity. Now, when I say the speed of gravity, I mean that if you had been standing on top of one of the towers and dropped a steel ball straight down and nothing impeded it, and you stayed on top of the building, you and the steel ball would have hit the ground at the exact same moment. Now, that's impossible. If the buildings were indeed collapsing on each other, there's resistance. You wouldn't fall at the same speed as a ball falling free fall that distance. These buildings, each floor is being demolished. We had a man by the name of Jeff King at our event in New York City who said he had a demolition expert look at it. And the guy said, oh, yeah, see the little puffs of smoke coming out? That's the charges going off.
And he was commenting on what bit of film when he said that?
On the Twin Towers. He was watching it with Jeff King. They were watching the CNN thing. And you can see the little puffs of smoke coming out. And then they keep billowing out. Now, the only concrete in these buildings was in a poured steel-framed pan that connected all the floors together. Now, you can't have it both ways. And by that, I mean, to pulverize concrete takes a massive amount of force. If you ever try to break a concrete slab, you'll know what I'm talking about. You can break it up into chunks, but you don't get fine powder. So they're talking about a huge impact, another impossibility because we've done the calculations there. And if you have a huge impact, you have to have resistance. So if you're pulverizing the concrete, that means the steel bolts around the rim of that concrete pan had to hold. But the force required to shear those bolts is less than the force required to pulverize concrete. Moreover, the 911 commission report entirely ignored the 47 core columns in the building, like they didn't exist. And so they're showing each floor falling like a single floor. They claimed that the center of the building was only a hollow elevator shaft, when in fact there were steel columns that were as thick as 4 inches thick in a tube, which is actually stronger than a beam in some ways, at the bottom, at 2 inches in the middle, and at the very, very top, a quarter inch. Well, these steel beams held the floor along with the external skeleton of 126 steel columns, like made like that. All of these columns are bound together by welded steel plates to form a strap at each floor. Now, perhaps you could crush the floor below, but there's no way you could take those straps and force that thing to fly apart like you see it in the videos, because you see steel beams that are 150 feet away from the building. These things are massive things. They would fall straight down, perhaps. They wouldn't be blown halfway, over a block and a half away.
Now, you must be aware that to a lot of people who accept the official version that you're going to sound like a left-wing conspiracy nut. Are you a left-winger? We had a conversation off the air earlier. You told me you were your family was a Republican and...
Well, I used to be a Republican, but I am now a left-winger. And proud of it. I kicked the habit. You can too.
So, but what is it that made you question the official version in the first place?
Well, first off, I didn't question the official version in the first place. I thought at most it was a sin of omission, in that they knew it was happening and let it happen for the political fallout that they were going to get. I couldn't believe these guys could get away with that, especially with, well, actually, I didn't even know about NORAD first. That's not quite true. But then someone could, Joe, I went to all of these protest meetings. I was against the Iraq War. I'd been watching the internet, and I ran full-page ads about that back in February of last year while the Security Council was going on, mm-hmm. saying that Powell lied and telling about the last time he lied and the time he was lying now. And
I was actually digging through an old stack of magazines at home the other day, and I found a Newsweek edition that came out the day after Powell presented his evidence to the UN, and the summary of his evidence, which they claimed was so compelling, seems quite ridiculous now.
Yes.
But anyway, I didn't mean to sidetrack you.
No, but that's all right. But so I was going to the Iraq War protest thing, and Eric Hufschmid was there with his book, Painful Questions. And I bought the book and never got around to reading it, and I had the video and never got around to watching it. Like I said, I was thinking that the 19 Arabs did this. Maybe it was somebody turning a blind eye, but they did it. But then I watched the tape, and it was an epiphany. when I saw the, not just one, not just two, a list of over 12 factors, which I put in my ad, by the way, and of things that were entirely against the possibility that 19 screw-ups from Arabia somehow performed high-precision, high-G forces and airplanes that aren't meant to do it to execute what they did. The list is amazing. At the Pentagon, they have a small hole, maybe 20 feet wide, no wing marks on the building at all. Okay, and contrary to what people think, the building plane did not come in at an angle. The plane came in straight level. They have pictures of whatever hit it. But you compare that hole with the hole in the World Trade Towers. Now, they say at the Pentagon, oh, the wings pulled it up and went inside. Well, that doesn't happen. I mean, that's ridiculous. And compare the holes, because if you look at the hole in the World Trade Towers, you can plainly see the wing and the tail mark. But at the Pentagon, there's one small hole, and even the if you see the first pictures after the attack, you can see that all seven stories of the Pentagon are still holding. Now, they're not totally intact, but they're holding. And that means the airplane with the 44-foot tail did not even sever through one of the floor sections above it. What really hit the Pentagon was something much smaller. Most eyewitnesses said it was the size of a commuter plane. And the pictures clearly show a rocket from what must be the Pentagon's defense system firing at this much smaller aircraft that's in their own video that is about to hit the Pentagon.
Do you think we're ever going to get to the bottom of any of this stuff?
Not if George W. Bush is reelected.
It seems to me like Bush and Kerry share a lot of the same backers, and they're funded by a lot of the same people. In fact, four out of each of their top 10 donors are the same. So I'm wondering if whether this is going to be something that we're going to have to wait 30 or 60 or 70 years to get documents that are slowly released under the Freedom of Information Act if it still exists 30 years from now. I'm puzzled by whether we're ever going to find anything out. Is really the question.
800 victims in New York, a couple hundred more in Virginia at the Pentagon, and allegedly more on the aircraft. That's a lot of people who want to get to the bottom of this. We are right now forming a grand jury in California to indict Cheney and Bush, and we are petitioning...
On what charge?
Murder. Cheney in particular. Cheney was at the controls of a U.S. military exercise on September 11th that was chasing hijacked aircraft. 26 of them or something like that, I believe. And the reason our aircraft didn't get to the real ones is Cheney kept directing them to ones that weren't there out over the ocean. This thing, Richard Cheney couldn't be found that day because he was in the Presidential Command Center. Michael Rupert, in his book Crossing the Rubicon, clearly indicts Cheney. There is no other way this could have happened. NORAD normally intercepts...
This is the North American Air Defense Systems.
Correct. Normally intercepts a plane that has gone off course, not responded to ATC air traffic control, or turned its transponder off or to the hijack code within 20 minutes. They did that 67 times in the 12 months preceding 911. Yet on 911, they failed to intercept the only four aircraft that were had a 20% load factor that morning that were transcontinental flights, and those four unusually low-loaded, empty aircraft were the four hijacked aircraft who just happened to make it through all the air defense systems.
By 20% load factor, you mean they're only 20% full, the seats?
If they had 100 seats, only 20 seats were full.
Right.
And they're transcontinental flights, and normally those are 70 to 90% full. American Airlines said it was a computer glitch. Well, that was really a great lottery to win the four that are lowly loaded or the four that are the hijacked aircraft.
That does sound quite incredible. And it's actually one of the angles that's almost never covered. We had David Griffin on the show about 3 weeks ago, and he was pointing out that at least six, maybe up to nine of the 19 hijackers have been reported alive and well in various parts of the world. Are you aware of that?
I am aware, and the FBI has not changed its list of that as well. But there's a thing called Operation Northwoods, mm-hmm. which the Joint Chiefs of Staff cooked up after John F. Kennedy promised Khrushchev we wouldn't invade Cuba, in which they would take Army personnel, dress them as civilians, put them on a civilian aircraft with a military captain, land at an Army base, take a remotely piloted aircraft, a drone, cause it to take off, shoot it down, killing American civilians, and blame it on the Cubans as a pretext to invade Cuba. This has been in recently released Department of Defense documents that shows the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff planned to kill American citizens to provoke a war.
Now, Northwoods is pointed to as evidence of this kind of complicity and conspiracies being planned previously, but it didn't actually take place. It was kind of killed in action by President Kennedy.
Who died 6 months later, I might point out.
Yes, that's very true. And a lot of documents surrounding Kennedy's own death haven't been released yet. This is, you know, kind of brings me back to the question of, are we ever going to find out? Is it going to take 30 years for us to hear what was surrounding 9/11?
Well, the thing that we have going for us is the Internet. If it wasn't for the Internet, we wouldn't know and be able to do what we do know now. And right now, so many people know about this worldwide. It's mushrooming, because once you become a believer, you realize that something bigger, badder, and better equipped than 19 screw-ups attacked us, and they are really terrorists. We were attacked by terrorists, all right? They have terrorized this country into giving up its Constitution. And I believe that they will strike again before or on Election Day, like they did in Spain, even if it looks like Bush is in the lead, just to cement their power. Because imagine, Bush wins by the voting machines, which I don't trust anyway, and I don't trust these polls. But he wins, and then there's a terrorist attack the same day or the next day or the day before. He declares martial law. The Constitution is toast. Everybody says he won the election. She should be there. And we're gone.
Well, we're going to find out whether that's going to happen pretty soon, I guess. For people who don't know a lot about this, can you throw out a couple of websites they can check up? Because we're running out of time here.
Well, our own is reopen911.org. There's 911truth.org. And the best way is just go to Google and do it out. My own own company website is Walden, Walden, the number 3.org. But we're mainly about creating practical utopias and cities of the future. But I took this up because there's not going to be a future if these guys plunge us into 1984, which it sure looks like they're doing.
Well, I definitely share your concern with some of the inconsistencies in the official version, to say the least, and I think a fuller investigation is absolutely needed. But I'm afraid on that note, we're going to have to leave it because we're out of time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. That was Jimmy Walter. You can check out his website, walden3.org. And before him, we had Hermann Schwartz, professor of law at Washington College of Law at the American University, and his book is Right Wing Justice. That's all the time we have this week. Next week's Sunday Monitor will feature interviews with Gore Vidal on American Empire, Charles Lewis from the Center for Public Integrity on the buying of the president, and Leon Smith, the editor of the Crawford newspaper that switched endorsements from George Bush to John Kerry, will be joining us as well. Next week's show will be at 6. That's the 31st of October. It's the last show before the election. If you're a football fan, and I am, you may be interested in watching the game between the Washington Redskins and the Green Bay Packers next week. Since 1932, the result of the last Redskins home game before a presidential election has accurately predicted the election result. A win by the Redskins has meant that the incumbent party or president gains another term in office. A loss by the Washington team at home that weekend has coincided with a victory for the challenger in the presidential election. At least we found a fun way to combine sports with politics, so maybe you'll watch that next week and we'll see what the result looks like. For Byron Jackson and Margaret Bryan, this is Mark Ribari saying goodbye. Join us next week at 6. This is KPFT Houston. Coming up next is Pan-African Journal with Akua Holt. Stay tuned.